I'm Riley Reese. This is the Sophia Unfiltered podcast, where we bring together thought leaders, wellness entrepreneurs, makers, and emerging health leaders. We're here to have raw, unfiltered conversations because sharing your stories has the power to change lives, help others heal, and transform the way we take care of ourselves. Here we go. This episode contains discussion of suicide. If you or someone you know are experiencing suicidal thoughts, you can connect with a 24-hour suicide and crisis lifeline by dialing or texting 988.
Welcome back to another episode of Sophia Unfiltered. Michelle and Riley are both here today to introduce you to our guest, William Negley. William Negley is the founder and president of SoundOff, an IT-based nonprofit support network for U.S. military veterans. He created SoundOff in response to the tragedy of losing his brother-in-law, Navy SEAL Bill Mulder, to suicide. Bill was a member of SEAL Team 6 and struggled with post-traumatic stress and alcohol abuse after multiple deployments. Despite seeking therapy and treatment, his mental health deteriorated, ultimately leading him to die by suicide in 2017, just 5 months after leaving a decorated 20-year career in naval special warfare. In response to this personal tragedy, William, a former CIA operative, created the SoundOff app to provide anonymous mental health support to covert operatives and special operators. This initiative aimed to help them overcome stigma and security clearance concerns, while at the same time addressing the increasing suicide rates in the military. SoundOff is now available for all veterans, service members, and intelligence community officers. William Negley, doing important work in the world. Welcome. We are so happy to have you with us today.
Thank you. Thanks for having me. Excited
of course. To be here. Yes. So tell our listeners a little bit about you and about your background and how you got to be where you are.
My story really is kind of the story of the creation of SoundOff. So I grew up in San Antonio, and my mother's a mental health professional. She's a Jungian analyst. So I jokingly say that I grew up on a couch, right? Stigma was certainly not a thing in my household. There was a lot of discussion of dreams and feelings and all the like in my mother's household. And much to her Jungian analyst total stereotype shock, she had a son who wanted to go into the CIA and go fight terrorists. Not totally in sync with what she thought she was, you know, kind of going on in her household. So I joined the CIA in 2009, and 2011 is when we started to hear this 22 veteran suicide a day number. That's when that number started to kind of permeate society. And I did not know any of the research on this. I was not a clinician. I was not an academic in this space. I was just a CIA officer sort of living this life. It was just very evident to me that there was a fundamental flaw in how we were supporting this broader veteran service member intelligence community. And that flaw is that it did not matter how much money anybody was investing in the care of this community. And that could be federal government, that could be VA, DOD, that could be CIA mental health resources, but that could also be private sector, nonprofit, state, local community. If that individual would not come in and proverbially sit down on the couch and talk about what was going on, all that money and resources were irrelevant. And again, I didn't have the research. I didn't know the research on this. I just knew it because I was living it. A lot of these men and women were not going to come in and expose themselves, right? Like my buddies and I, my best friend who's about to go to Yemen on his first tour tomorrow is not going to come in to CIA Mental Health Services and talk about his drinking problem, right? Like that's just a non-starter discussion. So it seemed equally intuitive that if the fundamental barrier to many of these individuals seeking help was a personal and professional desire for anonymity, why don't we just allow them to seek help without anybody knowing? Not with confidentiality, but with uncompromising anonymity. And that, you know, idea, and I'll let into this conversation, making a mistake that is very common with people in our organization when looking at our organization. People think that this started when Bill died. Terrible tragedy is that I've been doing this for 3 years before him. So I started this organization when I came back from Afghanistan in 2013. But the very problem that we worked to address was itself so insidious. I don't want anybody to know that I'm struggling. It's going on in my own family, and I just don't know. So here for 3 years, I'm literally running around with PowerPoint decks and RAND studies talking about barriers to seeking care. And Bill, meanwhile, is, you know, tragically struggling. And then June 9, 2017, I'm literally walking on stage at business school to sort of talk about Sound Off. And I get the call that Bill has died by suicide. So the idea sort of first started to take shape 2011. Took about 2 years to say, okay, I'm going to actually do this. And I was entirely naive to how complicated this would actually be. But the punchline is, it's exactly what we've done. So sorry, that was probably a lot more background to tell you about myself than you asked for. But that's a little bit of a decade of history in 2 minutes.
No, that was really powerful. And I didn't realize that that had been going on. So talk about knocking the wind out of you when this is the thing that you're focusing on and it's happening in your family and you're becoming an expert in this area and it's going undetected. So really speaks to the need for having such a thing.
And it made for kind of a uniquely powerful situation because it is not what you described. We had this tragedy happen and then we, you know, launched this organization to do it. It's just a very common experience in this space, right? And this, to be clear, it's not a criticism of this, but it's a very common thing for somebody to either die by suicide or get blown up or something terribly terrible occurs. And the family and loved ones start a foundation. And to be frank, what they do with those, what that foundation typically looks like is we're going to raise capital, right? That's just sort of the common, obvious thing. To some degree, what we're going to do with that capital is often an afterthought. And again, that's not I'm not criticizing it. It's just true. What was particularly terribly, tragically powerful is that, you know, I flew to Virginia Beach the day after my brother-in-law died. I've told this story before. I had two hats that I could not take off, and it was incredibly challenging. You know, I remember standing in our house in Austin, my wife and I's house, and I had these two hats. I've spent all day, every day for years trying to launch this organization squarely in this space. Like, I cannot remove that hat. And I love my sister and loved my, you know, brother-in-law. And so I'm going to walk in. I just knew I was going to walk into this home and, like, meaning in Virginia Beach. And our lives have, I didn't know if Sydney knew, our lives have become inextricably connected in a different way than has ever occurred before. But I can't say that out loud, right? Like, I can't walk in and say, like, Sid, you know, I've been doing this and, like, we could now be incredibly powerful together. I can't say that. Well, the story is I didn't have to, right? I mean, I walked in, I sat down on the bed next to Sydney, and she was the one who said, like, this is exactly what you have been working on for years. And It wasn't that Bill got cancer. It wasn't that, you know, Bill as a tier one dev group operator had meaningfully unlimited access to mental health support, right? Like, I mean, the government pours unlimited money, you know, on a relative basis into those guys. He was never going to expose himself in a way that he felt would jeopardize his reputation or career. So by the time he was getting out, it's kind of terrible to say it this way, but quite frankly, it was arguably too late. I mean, he was so burned down and in such bad shape by the time he was getting out, because we would contend there was proactive, affirmative decisions over many years to not seek support earlier, precisely out of reputational, professional concern, which we sort of wrap up, we societally sort of wrap up into the catch-all term stigma.
Yeah, as a provider, I know that by the time somebody reaches me, oftentimes they're in such a state of disarray that it takes a lot of efforting to get them right facing forward. And through my career, I've been working in mental health for over 20 years. I've seen one operator in my office. I've been on retreats where there's operators, but they just, if I see an operator in my office, I know it's imminent because there's no way that they're coming in unless it's life or death.
I'm sorry, remind me where you live.
I'm in San Diego.
Okay. So like you're in a place where there's, you know, between MARSOC and Naval Special Warfare, like there is, you don't live in a random place where there's not any, but I'm saying you're in a location where there would be a natural reason for people to come see you. And that's exactly the point, right? That we just know it, right? I mean, I started the full circle of this conversation. I started this with intuitive knowledge. These men and women are not seeking help, right? Well, what I have now come to learn and know, because I've been doing this for a long time, there's tons of research on this, right? I mean, there's tons of DoD-funded research telling us that the majority of those struggling are choosing not to seek help. And take it down a notch, we know why they're not seeking help. Again, we know all this intuitively, but there is meaningful DoD-funded research saying, in short, they don't want anybody to know they're seeking help. So, you know, where SoundOff started 10 years ago and exists today, I like to say, I'm not in competition with anybody. If someone is currently today willing to seek help through DoD, VA, nonprofit, Cohen, Headstrong, like anywhere else, private care, I want them to do that. I want them to do that. Our target audience is that, call it half of the population that we know isn't doing that. And we know somewhat definitionally is likely unwilling to do that precisely because they don't want anybody to know.
Now, I remember hearing about SoundOff. It was probably 5+ years ago. And I checked it out and I recommended it to people that I was seeing. I was seeing combat veterans at the time. I was like, this looks pretty good. I mean, it's confidential. The clients that I was showing it to, they were like, is it really confidential though? Like, is it? So could you just talk our listeners through, like, what is it like when you sign up for the app?
You set me up perfectly because I don't wordsmith, but there's a word that is very important for us to distinguish. Every mental health appointment that you've ever had has been confidential until it wasn't, right? I mean, that's the concern. We are not confidential. We are anonymous. And that's a very meaningful distinction. Confidentiality means I know who you are, but I'm essentially promising that I won't tell anyone. We don't know who you are. We are not protecting some identity and saying, I'm so tough, you know, I'm not going to tell anybody this information that I'm holding. The reason that we are an app, everybody builds apps, right? Like, it's the hot thing to do. I never wanted to build an app. I wanted to allow men and women to engage with support in an ongoing basis, right? Talking to the same clinician or peer, but maintaining anonymity. And the only way that I could think to do that was through this piece of technology. So to your question, first, at the most basic level, when you're coming into our application, not only are we not asking you for, you cannot provide us your name, your email address, your phone number. You are not able to give us identifying information. We provide you a username. So beyond that, I recognize that fundamentally there's a certain amount of trust that goes into this, right? But it's, I was having this conversation recently, and you can say it one of two ways. You don't have to trust me at all because you're not providing any information for me to access. Perhaps the more sophisticated way to say it would be, you got to trust that there's not some secret collection of who you are, even when you're not handing it to us. What I can say in either case is there's no reason for us to be doing any of this if we're like undermining the very premise of why we're doing it, right? I mean, we're not making money in any of this. None of this is revenue generating. And believe me, it would be a lot more attractive business model if we were capturing identifying information and we could go say, see here, I can prove that this person's a veteran or something else. Now, just one thing to emphasize, both for the people potentially seeking support, viewing on this, and for the clinicians. What an individual chooses to disclose to a clinician is a different conversation, right? So the clinician cannot magically unveil who an individual seeking help is. But if an individual seeking help in our application, the first words out of his mouth is, my name's John Smith, and I live in San Antonio, Texas, you know, you can't put that back in the box. So, but of course, the distinction there is, we're not forcing you to disclose your identity just to walk in the door. That's the real meaningful distinction.
And it seems that clinicians could be reminding, this is completely anonymous unless you choose to make it not. And could it be a cry for help too? If I say, I'm John Smith, here's my address, but don't call for help and I'm going to take my life right now. It seems that if they're disclosing that information, it could be a cry for help, although maybe it's not even conscious to them that that's what it is.
And by the way, and I've, as you might imagine, I've only had this conversation with 10 or 12,000 clinicians. If that situation were to occur, we would tell that, we would not direct any clinical direction of any kind to any clinician, but our general counsel would be, if you would normally be responding in that situation and that person has disclosed that information to you, you should probably be acting on that information. So it's not somebody gets to disclose all of that information, say, I'm going to take my life right now. And we just, you know, we magically handcuff the clinician and say, no, you can't respond to that. Of course, they should be responding to that.
Yeah, I know there's a lot of, you know, there's a lot of resources for veterans, there's apps, there's all these things. I really like what makes you guys different too, is that it's not just this random person that's picking up. Like, you can actually go and search the clinician, you know who you're working with, you can work with the same person, or if you prefer to talk to another veteran or a peer, you can have that support too. So I have to direct people to the crisis line or 988 because I mean, that's just my professional responsibility, knowing that will people call? I don't know if they'll call because I know sometimes you get a good person on the line. Sometimes you get somebody that is really misattuned. So I want people to know that you really are empowered to choose who you want to work with. You could work with a different clinician each time until you kind of find that right fit that feels like this person gets me.
A few things in there. First, what I emphasize, experience level that is really fundamentally different about SoundOff is the ability to be anonymous and engage with a clinician or a peer, the same clinician or peer over and over and over, right? The VA crisis line, is sort of anonymous, not really, and frankly, I think ethically probably should not be anonymous. But under any set of circumstances, you're certainly not calling and then a week later calling back and saying, hi, can I talk to, you know, that person that I spoke? That's just not what it's there for. Now, I will emphasize one thing, again, sort of where we fit in this broader, you know, as you said, a lot of resources. We're not a crisis hotline, right? So we say up front, if somebody is acutely in crisis at this moment and they've never engaged with SoundOff or somebody on SoundOff, they don't need to be calling. They don't need to be coming to us, right? They need to go to the crisis line or, unfortunately, an ER or any other number of, you know, sometimes good, sometimes not so good answers. But, you know, to your point of sort of pick your own adventure, if you will, you know, the peer support piece to this, quite frankly, you know, 10 years ago, it was sort of just like an add-on thought. Like, okay, you know, we can do that too. Now, there's two elements to it. One is, quite frankly, it's very scalable, right? I mean, and I think this is why societally we're seeing an increased exploration of peer support, because we just have such a mental health professional shortage in this country that we need some other outlet for these men and women. And we also, in the spectrum of care, you know, not everybody needs to be talking to the clinical psychologist, right? I mean, maybe I just can talk to a buddy. But then I had somebody say this to me 2 months ago, and I'd never really thought about it this way. And it was very powerful. I was at, I was in your neighborhood. I was at WARCOM, Naval Special Warfare Command, Coronado. And I was there with Sarah Wilkinson, who lost her husband to suicide a year after my brother-in-law died. She and my sister are now very close. And we were speaking at their mandatory suicide prevention training thing. And I was sharing sound off with the room, and I was speaking to a SEAL who said, you know, I really, really like this peer support thing. He said, I have not been willing to speak to a clinician. This is what he said. He said, they haven't earned the right to hear my suffering. And I'd never heard it said that way. And I was just like, that's it, right? He said, now, I'm saying this tongue in cheek because Green Berets and Navy SEALs are always at each other's throats. But, you know, would he talk to a Green Beret, right? Like somebody who's, you know, lost brothers and sisters and been in those firefights and had those struggles? Yeah. And so, you know, as an anecdote, that person subsequently came on, registered, and went through the training to become a peer supporter. But, you know, we don't need to answer for that individual where they feel comfortable accessing help. I think we have an ethical obligation to make sure that we are providing, you know, some standard of care, not lowercase, all of that, not in a medical sense, but not just random people without any training, but some level of vetting and competency and professionalism. But beyond that, if they want to talk to that peer, they can. If they want to talk to that clinician, they can. If they want to start with one and go to the other or do both at the same time, like, let's just let them do what they need to do.
So you make a good point about clinicians not deserving to hear the story, and really feel that this, with a lot of people, this wound is so sacred and it's so deep that the risk of being received with misattunement is so great that it's like, no, I'm just not going to reveal that. So really like how they can kind of sniff out the clinicians too, and just see who's, I mean, it seems like the people on your app are heart-centered. Like they're really doing this because they want to be there, because they care. They're not just phoning it in and, you know, they want a paycheck. It's like, I want to help and my wish is to help this community.
Yeah. And this isn't exactly what you were, where you were going, but it's worth saying this out loud. Amongst some in this community, there's a big focus on cultural competency. You know, you have to know the difference between a a Navy SEAL and a Green Beret, right? Do I think that is true to a certain degree? Yes. Here's the counter argument. Full circle, this conversation, my mother. My mother does not know the difference between, you know, a Marine and a Green Beret. But she's a damn good clinician and has saved some people, you know, some veterans and service members' lives. And I don't think a single one of them cared that she screwed up this word or that word, right? Because she was highly competent, highly empathetic, engaged, wasn't checking boxes. She was fully dialed in with them, even if she wasn't getting the precise things correct. And of course, she also learned and, you know, said, oh, okay, now I know that, and I'll say this instead of that. So that's not a reason not to have cultural competency training and focus. I just sometimes feel like we get hung up on that instead of like just being a really good clinician, engaging with the people you're helping or your patients. Yeah, I mean, as to the people on our platform, I mean, look, SoundOff is a decade-long experience of a lot of different people, some on the platform, some totally not involved in the platform, or, you know, not being supporters on the platform, putting heart and soul into this, right? I mean, from donors to technologists to sort of mental health experts to lawyers. I mean, there's just been a lot of people who didn't need to do any of this, who were certainly not, you know, doing it for the money. Not to say that people aren't compensated, but, you know, nobody was getting wealthy off any of this. And yeah, I mean, now as we really drive our clinical and peer capacity, you know, even those clinicians who are compensated, you know, which there are plenty on our system, you know, I don't think anybody is struggling to find patients today, right? And there's only 30 or 40 or 50 technology platform things that you could register to sign up to be on and don't have the unique elements that SoundOff has that they could just pass on us. But, you know, what we engage with are clinicians who, by and large, have supported this community before, understand exactly what we're trying to do, and know that without people on the other side of the phone, right, without a clinical or peer support base, you know, the technology is irrelevant. So we're deeply grateful for those clinicians who have come in with this, you know, early, right? I mean, when frankly, there weren't a lot of people seeking help. And now there's a lot of complexity with people seeking help that some can see compensated clinicians, some can only see volunteer. I mean, there's a lot of business logic stuff to it. But, you know, fundamentally, they clearly are interested in helping and helping those that are not willing to walk in their, you know, proverbial door.
So William, I think what you have here is so valuable. It's so unique. It's so powerful. And I think once people start using the service, they would really want to use it again. But how do we get people to be courageous enough to take that first step of like, oh, really, I'm going to download an app and I'm going to sign in? So how do we get people into that system?
Well, first, I'm going to answer that. But I really want to say we are heavily capacity focused right now, right? Because if we have somebody do exactly what you've done, and then they're not able to engage with the clinician because either we don't have one or there's not somebody under the certain set of business logic rules that is visible to them, whatever, right? That's a terrible situation that unfortunately is happening now. They're able to engage with peers because peers have no geographic limitation and are just more visible to everybody because no peers are compensated. So that's basically my plug for, we absolutely are focused on the problem that you're highlighting, but we also have the problem of, we got to make sure we have enough clinicians and peers. The problem that you're highlighting, part of the challenge of being a unique role in this space is that you have to, you know, penetrate in saying you don't need to be concerned about the thing that you're concerned about with literally everybody else, right? So I was at WarCom and I said to the room, how many of you, there's literally a SoundOff poster hanging in the corner of the room because a former NSW commander had done us a solid and hung some posters. Okay, first, not that many people in the room have heard of it, right? That's problem number one. Okay, we can tackle that. Problem number two, I say to the people who have heard of it, can you explain to me what SoundOff is? And this SEAL, who was the one who ultimately went on to say, a clinician hasn't earned the right to hear my story. So SoundOff's an app that, you know, lets me get mental health support. Entirely misses the anonymous differentiating element. Well, 3 minutes later, when I've explained its anonymousness, he's jumping out of his seat saying, this is the greatest thing ever, right? But there's just a fundamental challenge that because nobody else does this, getting people who are total data, especially, you know, service members who are totally saturated with information, say, hey, this is a different thing. And I just need you to like pay attention for 1 minute so you can understand that this is a different thing, is a meaningful part of the challenge. I think that what we are going to see, and to some degree already are seeing, is it's just going to be predominantly a word of mouth effort, right? That the person who uses it, who sees it, this really is anonymous, you know, is going to tell the next man or woman. Now, the little life hack, organizational hack that we see in this is peer supporters are the cheat code to that, because you're kind of getting the person who, no, they're not seeking help, but they're in the technology, they're in the app, they understand how it works, they understand our role, they understand they're not seeing somebody's name, and they're in the community. So they get to go say, hey man, you know, if you're struggling, this thing really is like a different thing that you can check out. So we really place an emphasis on the peer support recruitment because it's kind of a twofer. You're getting the peer supporter, but you're also helping spread awareness of the resource within the very community that you're trying to support.
So I'm curious if any listeners are out there right now and they want to sign up. They're like, okay, you've convinced me. I'm going to give it a try. What does that look like for them? Like, talk me through step by step. What would they do?
So someone seeking help, you can go to the Google Play or the iOS Mac App Store on your phone. You're going to download an application. You're going to say, I'm a veteran service member or intelligence community officer seeking support. We ask you for a password and a PIN. So you have not anywhere in this given us your name, your email, your phone number, nothing like that. And then we're going to assign you a username. And just as a little anecdote, I did some paramilitary training at the agency. And the radio training, we would use the call signs, Bluefish, whatever, whatever, Blackfish, whatever, whatever. So our application is going to assign you a username that is a combination of a color, an animal, and a number. So it's going to say you are Blackfish 123. It's really important that you record that because we don't have some database with your email or phone number, you know, attached to that username. So then you're going to be dropped into sort of our core home screen, if you will. And we have three core channels of support that you can engage with simultaneously, independently, whatever you like. Clara is a clinically validated artificial intelligence chatbot. It's powered by a third-party company whose technology we white label. It was the last addition to the application. For us, it was very economically efficient. It's available 24/7. They've done a lot of work with depression protocols, PTSD protocols, suicide protocols. We also use it to train the individual a little bit just on how the application works. And if they want to use it, great. If they don't, they don't have to. Then we have our peer support and our clinical support. So we ask if you are seeking clinical support, we ask what state you are located in, because we have to pair you with a clinician where that's licensed in the state that you reside in. And then one thing that's really worth drilling into a little bit, we ask what branch you served in, and then within the branch, we ask if you served within any particular units. And it's worth just explaining what that does, because we see people say, I don't want to answer this. And that's really not ideal. So the way that SoundOff works is I do not raise money to pay for clinical support for Navy SEALs, Green Berets, or Marine Raiders, just as three sort of random examples. I partner with the Navy SEAL Foundation, Special Forces Charitable Trust, and the Marine Raider Foundation. And they underwrite clinical support for their community. So when someone selects and says, I was a Navy SEAL, or I was a Marine Raider, or I was a Green Beret, we are connecting them at an engineering level with those monies, clinicians, resources that those foundations are providing. If they don't answer the question, we unfortunately can't connect them with those monies. That's not to say there's no clinicians available, but it is far more limited, the clinical capacity they can engage with. So they're going to answer that question. They're going to be presented with a list of clinicians or peers that they're available to pair with. Bio, name, photo. They're going to select the clinician or peer they like. They're going to be dropped into an informed consent that they're going to check the box on. And then they're into an end-to-end encrypted chat conversation between that clinician or peer and that individual seeking help. And, you know, what we prompt them to do, though this doesn't always happen, is, hey, give a couple times in the next few days that you would be available for a session. Then that clinician or peer is going to come in. And again, this sort of classically how we envision the model, though it does not always occur this way, that clinician is going to schedule a time. And then the last piece to SoundOff, what makes it unique and powerful, is that that clinician has a button that they can hit that triggers a VoIP call internal to the application, so that you're able to have a telephonic clinical or peer support session without having to have the phone number of that individual seeking help. So you can maintain that anonymity of the individual seeking help. And then we have some surveys, again, none of which are identifying. And then rinse and repeat. The clinician has a little scheduling system to schedule a follow-up call for, you know, the next week or whenever they would deem appropriate.
No, I love it, because then people can think through that in their mind, and you're speaking to a lot of the traps that you fall into. But what about this? So you really were comprehensive in answering that. And I hope that folks will try it out. You know, if you try it once and it's not for you, then you don't have to try it again. But having the courage to try something different. And then for the clinicians out there, I know that I want to sign up now after talking to you. I'm like, okay, I'm in. So for clinicians, you know, we do a lot of pro bono work, and well, not a lot, but we are supposed to do some pro bono work, right? We got to feed ourselves, but it's a great way to serve and to give back. It's really important work.
Let me emphasize a couple things here. One, not everybody has to be pro bono. Again, we have, I will spare your audience the granular engineering logic of who gets to be compensated clinician and who does not. But what I am emphasizing here is this is not purely a philanthropic pro bono request of clinicians. Clinicians can be compensated, are compensated, and can be both pro bono and compensated. So if, you know, if we have funding for the Navy SEAL and you're registered as a contract clinician, you can be compensated. And then for the soldier where we do not have clinical, you know, financial underwriting, that could be a pro bono relationship. What I would emphasize to the clinicians and prospective peers out there is that you can download the application today, and instead of hitting seeking help, you can say, I'm interested in providing help. For clinicians, we've fully automated the onboarding process. We have a piece of technology that validates your license, that validates your identity. So it's a pretty quick, hopefully, it's a pretty quick, painless process. For prospective peers, again, it is also, much of it is automated, but we do require peer support training. And you can see in the application and our website what peer support trainings we've approved and how you can access them. But if you have been through a different peer support training, we don't want to bottleneck, like you have to be through this particular training. Just let us know what training you've been through and we can take a look at it. And if it looks good, we can approve that as well.
Yeah, William, thank you for being here. And second, you know, as a founder myself, I mean, you've worked at this for a short 10 years. You took an idea and turned it into reality, right? You said you were naive at the beginning. And I think that's what it takes, right? A lot of naivety and a lot of perseverance. And now to have all of the veterans, you know, be able to take part of something that you dreamed up years ago and all of that hard work. I mean, people really can't say thank you enough, right? I mean, it looks easy on when you've come this far, but I completely understand that journey. And that is, you know, I'm sure sometimes you wake up at the sacrifice of your family and you're like, why am I doing this? And then you remember, this is why we're here.
Yeah, I mean, I think you hit it right on the head. And this is not woe is me. This is not, it's worth stating in the nonprofit space, because nonprofits, you know, sometimes get a bad rap. Sometimes deservedly, sometimes not. There's no big payday at the end of this for me, right? This is not a, for this, I don't have some equity stake that, you know, I'll get to cash out on one day. Again, that's not a woe is me. It's a, yeah, I mean, believe me. I mean, again, as you know, this launching anything is challenging. The thing that I really am thankful for, quite frankly, is our early donors who would have been very justified after some time in saying, is this real, right? Or is this like vaporware, right? I mean, is any of this really going to happen? Because not many businesses or nonprofits can talk about something, build something, you know, to take 6, 7, 8, whatever years to meaningfully launch something. And it is truly only because we had donors, I'll never forget, a couple, you know, maybe 3 years ago, 4 years ago, right when we were launching our product, after our event, I was kind of, you know, going up to some of our early donors and I'm a little nervous because I'm thinking they're going to, you know, like, hey man, what's going, like, let's see what's going to happen. What's the holdup? And it was entirely the opposite experience. I mean, they fully understood what we were trying to do, that it was a methodical process. Now, we didn't have some massive burn during that period that we were lighting, you know, tens of millions of dollars on fire or something. But they weren't, you know, pushing, they were supporting. And so I think really, you know, the last year, as we've received this VA recognition, as we've really kind of established ourselves with this within the special operations community. Our team has grown a little bit in meaningful ways. And now we work to expand beyond the special operations space. You know, what I've shared with those donors is, you know, I hope you see, you know, you're feeling your philanthropic ROI, if you will, that you're seeing that this was worthwhile and thank you for sticking with us. And they did, and they have, without them, you know, this certainly would not have been possible. So
I have one more question. So we see that the data, and you mentioned early on that you were looking at the data is the same, right? We have the suicides are up, and we have unlimited resources in the military, especially, right? The dev groups and these special forces. And we really know that this is a word of mouth situation. People are signing up to yours because they tell the right story. This is an anonymous app. You can go here. It's safe. So what would you tell all of those, you know, newly enlisted lieutenants and the commanders? And what would you say to, you know, even the enlisted folks who are out there, yeah, who are over all of the, you know, the sailors? Like, what would you say, yeah, to them?
I mean, the first part of your question, tragically, 20 years later, and let's say meaningful resources in the last, you know, call it 10 to 15 years, you know, it's not getting any better. I mean, I'm not trying to put the VA on blast, right? I mean, that's the easiest thing to do in this space, and they've gotten in many ways impossible challenge in front of them. But, you know, the like little data nitpicking, like, oh, look, this is 0.2% better this year. Like, it's not getting any better. And I think what is tragically necessary, but I guess good, that is happening as a result of that is there's a lot less dogma about like, this is the answer, right? I mean, everybody's a little, I've seen it just in the last year or two. I think there's a little bit of desperation. Like, what do we do to try and move the needle on this problem? And, you know, the fact that the VA, and again, this is not a criticism, I'm glad they did this, but the fact that the VA put out a $25 million grand challenge, help us figure out how to do suicide prevention 5-10 years ago, that would have been sacrilege, right? We don't need outside counsel on this. We're the experts in this. So the fact that there's a little bit of what we're doing is not stemming this tide. What are we, you know, what can we do differently? Which makes room for something like us, which is a little outside the box. What do I say to those serving? To leadership, who is certainly not new, but to leadership, it's easy for me running Sound Off to say, oh, well, send everybody to us. That's not the right answer, right? The right answer is for us to try to change the cultural and structural challenges that these men and women face seeking support. And there is, you know, real tough guys that I know within the Naval Special Warfare community. I mean, leaders where they took sort of actions to encourage their men to seek support and limit concern for blowback to them to the degree they could do it. Like, that first and foremost is the most important thing, right? Like, don't have us, the release valve, if you will, be the right answer. Let's figure out how to make these men and women feel safe accessing help. Unfortunately, there is always going to, there's just an inherent catch-22 that for a certain percentage of the population, it's just going to run in direct conflict, right? Like the example I always use, the Navy is never going to give up knowledge of whether their F-18 pilots are, you know, acutely depressed, right? Like, for very reasonable reasons, they're never going to give up that knowledge. Even though we know that forcing that knowledge suppresses care, right? Like, we know that that's the case. It suppresses seeking care. That's just a catch-22 that I don't think we're ever going to square that. And so that's where SoundOff comes in, right? I don't answer to the Navy, so we can get those people help. And so what I would say to those struggling is, if you are not comfortable accessing care through VA DoD channels, there's a lot of good organizations in this space where you can engage with care. Stop Soldier Suicide, Headstrong, Cohen Network, Given Hour. There's a lot of organizations out there supporting this community that are not inherently tied within the DoD. If you are still not comfortable accessing care through those independent channels, by all means, download the SoundOff application and we can connect you with our AI. We can connect you with a peer, and under a limited but growing set of circumstances, we can connect you with a clinician. But to me, the most important thing for everybody here is just do something. Tell somebody, seek care somewhere, because we know that the two common tragic outcomes of refusing to seek care.
Yeah. So thank you so much for speaking directly to our listeners, and I'm going to come in and land the plane. So there's three things that we ask every guest, or what are your personal pillars of mental health? You know, what keeps you facing forward?
Yeah. I mean, since I was as young as I can remember, I've been a mission-driven person, right? I mean, that's why I went to the agency. It's why I, not that this is what this conversation is about, but it's why I ran for office. And it's certainly why I'm doing this work. To like precise, again, this is not a complaint, it's not a woe is me, but like to absolute familial financial sacrifice. That's like really makes all of this, easier, I guess, when, you know, it's, I'm about mission and this organization is all about mission. To me, the other part is I've got, as we were discussing before the call, I've got a 7-year-old, she's about to be 7, a 4-year-old and a 3-month-old and a lovely age undisclosed wife. And that's just like, you know, in many ways, I have SoundOff and I have my family, and, you know, they have not busted in the door yet, but they, I'm sure, will shortly. And that makes, like, you know, when it's a long, long, long day or we're struggling with something, being able to be with them is just, you know, an invaluable mental health relief valve. I think I know the third answer, but if I was being fair to myself and my wife and the listeners, is I do not do an adequate job of is like physical stress relief, exercise. And I know I need to do more of that. I was a rower in college. And so that's the third, let's say, aspirational answer. But it's, you know, certainly the big one and two are just doing work that really matters, like deeply matters to me, and, you know, getting to be with my family.
Well, thank you so much for sharing yourself and your story with our listeners. You've said where they can find SoundOff on the app stores, wherever they get their apps. Where can they connect with you? Do you connect personally, or just to find out more about SoundOff, is there a website?
Yep. It's sound-off.com, sound-off.com. If anybody knows the owners of soundoff.com or soundoff.org, we will happily, we've been trying to buy those domain names for about 8 years. I'm at william@sound-off.com, so not complicated. But I make no promises on response times on my emails. And yeah, I'd love to engage with clinicians, love to engage with clinical organizations, peer supporters, peer support organizations, really any and all of the above. We are truly, you know, in the nonprofit space, it's common to talk about partnership, and that's really kind of like code for give us money. That's not the case for us. We are a deeply partner driven model. And so we want to engage with people who are interested in helping and working in this space.
William Negley, thank you for the work you are doing in the world. You're really helping so many people, and just so thrilled to have you on.
Thank you so much.
Thanks so much for listening. This has been Sophia Unfiltered, a podcast by Sophia Health, the number one marketplace for health and wellness. Find services, classes, and products from the top health and wellness providers. Book an appointment or join live classes now. I'm your host, Riley Reese. If this episode resonated with you, we'd love to hear about it in the comments section of your favorite podcast provider or with a 5-star rating. Let us know what your biggest takeaway from this episode was, or share it with someone you hope to inspire. Join us again next time for more real conversations, stories, and insights that help empower you with the knowledge and inspiration needed to transform how we care for ourselves.